Okay, so this talk will have, or this series of talks will have overlap with things that I know, at least I know some of you in the audience have heard before, talking about Gaussian free fields, what that means to talk about the contour lines of the Gaussian free field, as well as other sorts of random lines that you can derive from the Gaussian free field, which includes all of the SLEs and various loop ensembles and so forth. And so I'm going to try to give a little more detail than I have in previous talks as to what's the abstract machinery behind all this stuff, and a little more of an idea of how some of these things are proved. This includes work with Strom, Strom and Wilson, and with Werner. And the thing with Strom is we have a very large paper. It's now 110, 120 pages. It probably we're going to find a way to split it into two. That really just deals with these level lines, and I like to think that's near completion. But we've been working on this for quite a while. And I'm actually describing the level lines of the free field, and there's additional work that describes some of the other sets I'll describe, and work with Vendelin on loop ensembles, and another work with Strom and Wilson on loop ensembles. Okay. So first, this should be review for most of you. It's a standard Gaussian on an n-dimensional Hilbert space. I just give you an inner product, and then you take the density function to be proportional to e to the minus norm squared of the vector divided by 2. And one thing is that you can write a sample from distribution as a sum of alpha sub I v sub I's, where the alpha sub I's are IID Gaussians. Okay, and mean zero unit variance Gaussians. So whenever I have a Hilbert space, I'll refer to this as the standard Gaussian. And so the discrete Gaussian free field, well, it's just a standard Gaussian in a certain Hilbert space. And so the Hilbert space is the set of real-valued functions, f, on the vertices of some planar graph. Call it lambda here. And then h of f, all defined to be the energy of f, Hamiltonian, that's the, also it's called the Dirichlet inner product of f with itself. So it's the Dirichlet form of f with g is basically the inner product of their gradients. So what it means is it's the sum over all edges of the amount f changes across that edge times the amount that g changes across that edge. And so the Dirichlet energy is just this h. That's the inner product of f with itself. And if I fix a function f naught on the vertices, on some boundary vertices, so I declare some subset of the vertices of lambda to be the boundary, and I fix some values on that, then the set of functions that agree with f naught is isomorphic to Rn, where n is the number of interior vertices, and the discrete Gaussian free field is just a random element of this space, probability given by e to the minus h of f over 2. So in particular, if you have zero boundary conditions, the Dirichlet energy is just an inner product. It's a norm on the space, and this is a standard Gaussian. So, for example, here's an actual picture of discrete GFF on a 20 by 20 grid with zero boundary conditions. And so you can see, if you go back to the form of this energy, so you're taking basically the sum of the height difference squared over all the edges, and The energy is going to be small when the function is roughly constant, and when the function has a lot of jumps, the energy will be large. So when you take e to the minus the energy, the density will be largest on functions that are roughly constant. So you get a function that looks kind of continuous, but also has some noise, some fluctuations. Some properties of the discrete gas and free field. So I already mentioned that it's a standard Gaussian on that if you have zero boundary conditions, you can think of it as a standard Gaussian with the Dirichlet inner product. Also, if I give you boundary conditions F naught, other boundary conditions, then the discrete Gaussian field is just an affine translation of what you get with zero boundary conditions. So you just add a deterministic function that's the discrete harmonic extension of these new boundary conditions. And so, you know, if you want to sample with any boundary conditions, you can first sample with zero boundary conditions and then add the harmonic function, discrete harmonic function with these other boundary conditions. And then it has this Markov property that if I condition on the values of F on some subset of the vertices, conditioned on that, the law of F everywhere else is just that of a Gaussian free field where I take as the boundary, my original boundary, plus these new vertices with the heights I've observed on them. Okay? So, probably at least many of you have seen these definitions before. So now the continuum Gaussian free field is just a standard Gaussian on an infinite dimensional Hilbert space. So fix a planar domain D. Let H, usually by domain I mean simply connected open set. Fix a planar domain D and let H of D be the Hilbert space closure of a set of smooth compactly supported functions on D under this Dirichlet inner product, which is in this case, the continuum, you take the inner product, the integral of the dot product of the gradients. And the nice thing about this Dirichlet inner product is, well, first of all, it is scale invariant. So if I were to stretch my domain, multiply my domain by a factor of 2, say, and not rescale the function, just stretch it out horizontally, so not rescale the heights, not rescale the vertical value, so I stretch it out, then what happens to this integral? Well, you know, the area has now gone up by a factor of 4, 2 squared. But each of these gradients has gone down by a factor of 2. So the product has gone down by a factor of 4, so the integral is the same. And also if I rotate on my domain, rotate the functions, that also doesn't change the integral. And so if you take a conformal transformation, that just locally looks like a composition of a rotation and a dilation and a translation. And it's just a change of variables formula. It says this inner product is conformally invariant. Okay, so and so you can view the Gaussian free field as it's the formal sum. H is the sum of alpha sub I, F sub I, where the F sub I's are an orthonormal basis of H, and the alpha sub I's are ID Gaussians. And, well, this sum almost surely does not converge point-wise. But H can be defined as a random distribution. So it means, if I take any smooth function, with probability 1, these partial sums, the inner product of the partial sum of H with this smooth function is going to converge for every smooth function. So with probability 1, this is true for every smooth function. So the inner product of H with phi is well defined whenever phi is smooth. I also want to say that if I project the Gaussian free field onto the space of functions that are piecewise linear on a triangular lattice, and that's going to give me the discrete Gaussian free field unrelated graph. So let me just draw that. If I were to take some triangular lattice, let's see if I can actually draw a triangular lattice of some kind. And restrict my attention to functions that are piecewise linear on the triangles. Okay, that's a subspace of H of D. And so if I just project my Gaussian free field onto this subspace, the finite dimensional subspace, so in this finite dimensional subspace, well, the value of a function in the subspace is determined by the values on the vertices. If I know the value on 3 points of a triangle, and I know that it's an affine function on the triangle, then that, well, that determines the function. So it's determined by just the values on the vertices. And if I give you a function on the vertices and ask you what its energy is, you can check that it's just, you know, up to a constant, it's just this discrete, the energy you'd get, the discrete Dirichlet energy of this function on this graph. Okay. Thing I want to say is if you take rho to be minus the Laplacian of H, and you view that as describing an electric charge density, then H is its Coulomb gas electrostatic potential function. So viewing this as an electric distribution with the where you have the energy the force between 2 points is proportional to the distance between them. So in 2 dimensions, it's natural to have force decay not like 1/r², but like 1/r. So if you use that natural force, then if rho is minus the Laplacian of H, then H is the electrostatic potential function, and grounded at the boundary of D. And then the Dirichlet norm squared of H is viewed as the total potential energy, or if you like, the energy of assembly of the distribution. So one way to think of what this Dirichlet energy is that if I take of H, I think the H is just the potential function for a charge distribution, and the Dirichlet energy is just the amount of energy it takes me to assemble the charges into that configuration. How much force does that require? So the Laplacian of the Gaussian free field is a random distribution, and you can interpret that as a random continuum charge distribution. So this is one of the things that can be called a Coulomb gas, is the Laplacian of the free field. Coulomb gas is sometimes you require that point particles be discrete. You don't have this, you know, so, but this, well, this is something that you could call W. Huckel Coulomb gas, I guess. Is the Laplace, minus the Laplacian of the Gaussian free field. Okay. All right. Now, let's start talking about level lines. Okay, let's suppose I define the discrete Gaussian free field on this triangular lattice, and I fix some boundary values. And I fix them to be positive at these black vertices on the boundary, and negative, or positive at the white ones, and negative at the black ones. And then I sample a Gaussian free field on the inside. So I have some fixed values on the boundary. I haven't decided exactly what they are. I haven't told you exactly what they are, but they're deterministic. They're negative on one side, positive on the other side. And then I choose a Gaussian free field of the interior. Okay, and then I color according to sign of what I got in the interior. So these colors here represent one possible realization of of the Gaussian free field. Then, if having done that, I want to look at level lines of this function, I will notice that there will be a level line. Let's see, does this work? Yes, there will be a level line starting at this point and ending at this point up here. A level line of height 0. Because it's positive here, negative here, so some point in the middle it's going to be 0. And if I ask what does that level line do, well, you can see that on this particular triangle, if it's minus here, the level line has to go like this. It has to be a straight line. It will exit some point here. And then it will exit some point here, here, here. And if I follow this around and look at the path until I get to here, what you see is that the edges that you cross, when you do this, are exactly the duals of the edges in this picture down here. So in this picture, I've just replaced every vertex with a hexagon, and these edges are the duals of the edges in this interface between black and white down here. So sometimes it's easier to look at this picture with hexagons than this picture up here, so I like to draw my pictures using hexagons. So you imagine I fix the boundary values on these outside hexagons. I sample the inside ones. And a level line is approximately, and it will be the same in the scaling limit, given by this interface. Okay. So this theorem, what's shown is that if the initial boundary heights are lambda on one boundary arc and minus lambda on the other boundary arc, where lambda is this special constant, square root of pi over 8, and the discrete Gaussian free field is normalized so that it agrees with the continuum one, meaning it's the projection of the continuum Gaussian free field, that sort of the natural normalization. Then the scaling limit of the zero-height interface as the mesh size tends to 0 is SLE4. And if the initial heights were instead minus 1 plus A times lambda on one side and 1 plus B times lambda on the other side, then as the mesh size got finer, the random paths would converge to SLE 4A, B, which is a variant of SLE 4. Okay. So here's an actual picture of this. I took a Gaussian free field. I put minus lambda boundary conditions on this side, plus boundary conditions on this side, and then I sampled with Mathematica a free field all the way at all the hexagons in the interior. And then I drew in dark here this interface that gives the boundary between positive and negative height hexagons. So this is the random fractal path right here. And here's a surface view of the same function. So I just kind of viewed this function. If you view this function as a 90 by 90 grid, and kind of 90 this way, 90 this way, then you can plug it into a Mathematica point plotter. And so you have a 90-90 grid, and that gives you, well, this. And if you, it's kind of hard to follow the level lines in this picture, but we know from before roughly where they are. Here's another picture. Well, now what I've done is I've said, let's just condition on the heights along this contour line and say, conditioned on those heights, what are the heights, expected heights, at the points out here and the points out here? So you can think of this as what you've done is someone gave you the Gaussian free field, and you're going to try to generate this contour line, but you're only going to look at the heights you need to. So you'll start drawing your path, and each time you get to a new hexagon, and you have to decide whether you turn left or right, you observe the height on that hexagon. Then you go further and you observe the height on that hexagon as you're drawing this path. And at the end, when you've drawn the whole path, you have observed the heights on all the hexagons immediately left and immediately right of the path. And you know their values. So conditioned on only those values, what's the expected height at the other hexagons? Well, we know that by that Markov property that it's going to be harmonic. The expected height will be harmonic. So what I've done here is I've just taken this path and fixed the heights on the boundary of the path to be those I got from the free field. So the heights on hexagons either side of the path. And then these other hexagons, I've drawn the harmonic interpolation of the values along this path and on this side. Okay, so this function is discrete harmonic over here and discrete harmonic over here. And here's a surface view of the same thing. So so what is striking about this picture, should be striking, is that even though there's a lot of jaggedness along the surface, a lot of randomness, this function is far from constant along there, once you get a little ways away from this function, so you're sort of close but not microscopically close. You know, you get 10 units away or 20 units away, it really starts to look more or less constant. So the expected height really looks more or less constant on one side and more or less constant on the other side. And so you might wonder, you know, would this remain true if I were taking a billion by a billion grid? Would it still be the case that if I went, you know, even roughly 20 units away or some, you know, small but not quite microscopic units away, it would start to look roughly constant? And the answer is yes. And that fact is what we call the height gap lemma. And I'll give a precise statement of that in a minute. The height gap lemma says that the intuition you get from this picture is correct. Namely, that when you condition on this path, the expected height is really roughly minus a constant on one side of the path and plus a constant on the other side. Okay. Well, you might ask, what if I chose different boundary conditions? Like, you know, I put minus 3 lambda and 3 lambda over here. What you can see is that, well, even though the boundary conditions are different on the outside, it's still the case that near either side of this path, it's minus lambda on this side and plus lambda on this side. And you can maybe see that more clearly in this picture. So right near this side of the path, this is still, so just at these points along here, this is still really minus lambda. And this is plus lambda in height over here. And then the function is harmonic, so it's basically a harmonic function extending minus 3 lambda here, minus 3 lambda here, and lambda right along this this path here.
Is it a significant that the path is sort of globally straighter?
Yes. That's right. So, you know, if I put you know, minus C on one side and plus C on the other side, the larger C is, the flatter this path is going to be. And yes. Okay. So so I've been using this phrase, as the mesh gets finer, a lot. And so now I will give a precise statement of what I mean by that. So let T sub G be this a triangular lattice. So in the whole plane. And let D be a domain whose boundary is a simple curve comprised of edges and vertices of this. And then the discrete zero boundary GFS, well, we know this is a projection of the continuum GFF onto the subspace, I'll call H sub T G of D, comprised of continuous functions that are linear on each triangle. And I'll let phi sub D be the conformal map from D to the half plane. So let's, you know, draw a picture here. I have some funny old domain that's comprised of a union of triangles in this triangular lattice. Let's see. Okay. So this is my domain, and it's got a boundary. Here, there's a nice, simple curve. So this is my domain, and there's a conformal map from here to the half plane. Okay, so if I give you any piecewise linear function here, I can pull it back to a function here, just by composition. And so now I have a subspace over here. And what I'm going to be interested in is if I look at, fix one point here, it's convenient to take the point I, but it wouldn't matter if I took any other fixed point, it would also work. And I'm going to fix this point I and define R of D. So I have this D in this map, I sub D. And I'm going to define this R sub D to be the in radius of phi sub D inverse of I in D. So if this point I here gets mapped to, for example, this point right here, then I can talk about the radius of this being, well, it's roughly, I guess if these are unit lengths, it's roughly 1.5 distance to the nearest point. Okay? And so the thing we're going to prove, and you can fix two points on the boundary, and I'll map these points to 0 and infinity. So if I pick two points on the boundary, say here and here, what I'm going to end up doing is taking my contour lines between these two points, and I'll have my function map one of these to 0, one of these to infinity, and some point in the middle is going to go to I. Okay, so when I say these paths converge to SLE 4, when you have these right boundary conditions, what I really mean is that the images of these paths in H converge to SLE 4. And the reason that I define it that way is because now these domains don't all have to be the same shape. You know, if I took them all diamond shape, then it's clear what happens. But this is a more powerful result if I say, well, I can take any old shape of a domain and define this path. And we still have this notion of convergence. And so when I say as mesh gets finer, what I'll really do is I'll take larger and larger domains, but I'll assume that this in radius is getting large. So you think about it, if this in radius is small, then the triangle containing this is going to be kind of macroscopic size. And if I look at the image of the triangle, it might look something like this. And if we know that the function is the image of a linear function here on this, well, it can't approximate the Gaussian free field very well. So it's clear that this in radius has to be getting large in order for you to really expect that that these paths could look like SLE. And in fact, that's sufficient. So it's necessary and sufficient. Mm-hmm. Uniform with respect to shapes.
And for each given configuration of the Gaussian field, you have uniform convergence for any shape of the discrete
space. Yes. Right. That's right. So what I've written here is that this R sub D goes to infinity, these subspaces. So for each D, you know, we have this linear subspace of H sub D, which maps over here to a linear subspace of H sub H. It's the image of these piecewise linear functions. And you'd like to say that these subspaces become asymptotically dense. And a necessary and sufficient condition for them to become asymptotically dense is that this in radius tends to infinity. And, you know, how do you go about proving that? Well, you know, to prove it's dense, it's enough to prove that you can get an arbitrarily close approximation to any smooth function. And so, because the smooth functions are dense. So, you know, you just fix a smooth function, and then, and you want to show you can approximate it really well with the piecewise linear function. Well, you know, just take the piecewise linear function that agrees with the smooth function on the vertices of this domain. And that turns out to do the job. So it's a very simple and short argument. Okay, so that's this lemma I said here, that for each fixed F, this domain, if I look at the projection of F onto this linear subspace for a value of D, then the distance between that projection and F itself is going to tend to zero for any fixed F as this R sub D tends to infinity. Okay, so that's what I mean as mesh gets finer. I mean that I'm actually taking larger and larger domains, but then mapping them back to the same domain, this H. And, you know, and I could have taken another domain besides H, but H is convenient to work with. It's the most convenient domain in which to draw SLE. Okay. So now I promised you a rigorous description of the height gap lemma, or a rigorous statement. So this height gap lemma is, you know, took us about 60 pages to prove. But the proof is conceptually not that complicated. There are just a lot of details and bounds and things that go into making it precise. So, right, so take any boundary conditions for a discrete gas in free field, bounded above by some universal constant, M. And I'll say non-negative on the right boundary arc non-positive on the left, that should say. If you like, just think of minus lambda on one side, lambda on the other side. That case is already plenty interesting enough. And then we're going to let lambda denote this discrete interface. So this path we've got here, gamma is going to be that discrete interface. And I'll let gamma sub t denote the interface stopped at some stopping time. So I have this discrete interface, and I'm just going to start drawing it in, and then I'll pick some time to stop, some random stopping time. Maybe, for example, I stop when the image of the capacity over on this side, the image of the capacity exceeds some constant. So, yes? When I say stopping time, I just mean, if you like, just look at whether the path goes left or right at each step. So your stopping time is a measurable function of that. It doesn't matter exactly what you take as your filtration, but so long as it only depends on the heights of the hexagons that you've seen so far. If you like, you can make it depend only on the signs. Either way, it tells you the shape of the path, and that's okay. All right, so you have some stopping time. And now what you want to say is that, okay, so take that stopping time, then I'm going to let f sub t look at the function where I just plug in lambda on the positive, the plus side of the interface, and minus lambda on the minus side. So remember, given this interface, we know the heights are positive on one side, we know the heights are negative on the other side. And I claim that that the harmonic measure was approximately lambda close to one side and minus lambda close to the other side. So let's say I put in exactly lambda. So I define this f sub t to be the function I get by putting in exactly lambda. Let me say that on a picture here. So on this picture, what that would mean would be, you know, if instead of having these random values on either side, if I just took, I drew the random path and then I went through and put exactly lambda at each of these hexagons up to some stopping time, maybe here. And I put exactly minus lambda, or sorry, lambda on this side, exactly minus lambda on this side, all the way up to here. That's the function I'll call f sub t. And then I'm going to define h sub t to be another function that's what I get where I take the actual values I saw, the actual heights, and take the harmonic extension of those. And if you believe what this picture is intuitively telling you, you would guess that these f sub t's and these h sub t's should be close to each other. And so what is it exactly that we prove? Well, okay, so you define these h sub t's and these f sub t's. Well, now fix a vertex in your set. For example, maybe this vertex here. You fix a vertex, and then you draw it in this path. And what I'm going to say, and then you I'm going to say is that as the in radius with respect to that vertex is tending to infinity, this difference tends to zero in probability. Okay, so you fix a vertex, and then once you fix the vertex, it is going to hold universally over all domains, all different kinds of boundary conditions you have, provided they're bounded above by this constant. You know, all shapes, all conformal maps, all stopping times. So, you know, so this holds uniformly over a very large set of things. It converges in probability. You know, so if you take any sequence of these things, it's going to converge in probability, provided you make sure that this in radius of this point is tending to infinity. And it also holds if you take this V to be a random vertex, supported on points of some distance from the boundary of D. So all that's required is that this vertex be far from the boundary of D. So, no, it's a strong result. What's that? Do I define the sampling scheme? So I'm sampling, well, I'm sampling from the Gaussian free field, but I'm only observing heights one hexagon at a time as I draw the interface. So, if you like, I start drawing this interface and I come to one hexagon and say, is it positive or negative? Do I turn left or right? And I look at the sign to decide whether to turn left or right, and so I sample that height with respect to the conditional law of the Gaussian free field of that height given the heights that I already know. So I sample that one height and then extend my interface further, I get to a new hexagon, I have to decide whether to turn left or right, I sample the height on that. And so that's what I do, I just sequentially sample these heights along the interface until at some point I decide to stop. The boundary conditions are fixed in advance. And this result holds universally over all kinds of boundary conditions, provided that the boundary conditions are bounded by some constant. Okay. So, all right, so how is this proved? Okay, so I'm just going to say a little bit about this. Essentially, you know, you've got one of these big domains. You draw your path up to some stopping time, and you want to say that, well, that the height is approximately lambda out here once you get a little distance away from this path. So what does that mean? Well, if I pick a vertex here, and I do if I want to know, given the heights along this path, what's the expected height here? It's the same as the expected height of the first time a random walk started at this point hits one of the heights I know. I take a random walk here, I start drawing this random walk, and run it, and eventually it hits this, and so the expected height at this vertex is equal to the expected height of the first height I know where this random walk intersects. So, if I want to prove this height gap lemma, really what I want to show is that if I condition on this path hitting the left side of this path, conditioned on that, the expected height is approximately minus lambda. And conditioned on it hitting the right side, the expected height is approximately lambda. So, okay, so what does that mean? So conditioned on hitting that path, so I draw the path, then I do this random walk. Conditioned on the random walk hitting the left side, the expected height should be approximately lambda. Well, okay, so to do that, what you really want to do is to you want to somehow argue that if I were to just look at this local picture in here, so just look at this random walk, stop when it hits here, and I just zero in on this ball. You want to say that what is happening in this ball is somehow, if this is a really small ball, what is happening in here is kind of independent of sort of the global picture. So you want to say that, you know, you draw this path, then I draw this here, and I look at this small ball. But regardless of what the entire path looked like, once I zero in on this ball, it's going to look pretty much like, like something independently chosen just from some law for this ball. So you really want, you know, doing is getting something, it's a tail triviality result. It says if I look at this path, this random walk stopped when it hits this path. So that gives, if I now take this point where it hits to be the origin, say, and I look at this random joint law of this path, I'll call this the interface and I'll call this the walk. Look at a joint law of the interface and the walk. Then, sort of as this box gets larger, these things are going to converge, certainly subsequently, to some law on an infinite random interface and a path coming from infinity and stopping when it hits this. So now I have this infinite interface, and I have this path coming from infinity and stopping when it hits here. Okay, and that's now what you'd like to say is that this picture is somehow tail trivial. I mean, how would you think of it? Well, so one rough way to think of it would be that you'd like to say that this measure has some certain Gibbs properties, which would be that you know, if I condition on say what happens outside this ball, and then I stop this random walk at the first time it hits the ball, and then I resample the rest of the random walk, and then I get a new origin, saying where the random walk hits. I'd like to say that this random walk is invariant, that this law is invariant under re-randomizations of that form. So I'd like to say this is a Gibbs measure, but not with respect to the usual kernels, but with respect to a sort of unusual set of kernels. Kernels that involve changing your origin because you resample the path. And then maybe given the path, you can resample a chunk of the interface conditioned on where the path hits. So you want this to say this measure is Gibbs with respect to a very odd set of kernels. And then you'd like to argue that there's a unique measure with this property. So that's roughly speaking what we do. Not exactly, but roughly speaking, that's what we do. I think it's sort of an interesting idea, this notion of looking, at a random walk, hitting this point, just focusing on this, zeroing in and getting an infinite measure on, a measure on infinite interfaces with paths coming from infinity. It's something we were, this idea of tail triviality, uniqueness of Gibbs measures of things like this is something that, we thought in principle might be useful for other problems, for, self-avoiding walks or for these easing models or other things. That's kind of speculative. But so, we had developed this whole machinery of, basically the hard part is how do you decouple what happens in a really small ball from what happens outside a larger ball? And you want to say, I tell you what happens outside a larger ball, what happens in a small ball is more or less independent. And so you want to say, well, I give you the small ball, this large ball, and if I gave you anything in the small ball, it would be fairly natural for these paths to hook up without too many catastrophic things happening. So it's a story where you I give you an interface out to here, and I give you what it looks like inside, and you want to say that the probability that these things actually do hook up is sort of remains macroscopically large under some conditions, independently of the exact shapes of what's inside and outside. And that uses a whole bunch of tricks. So, one of you poor souls is going to have to referee this paper. That's the idea. A lot of tricks. Okay, so once we get this height gap lemma, there's an important property of SLE4. SLE4 is the only random path that satisfies the following. Namely, that if I satisfies the property that if I condition on the path up to some stopping time, so it's a path, say, going from this point to this point, I condition on this up to a stopping time, and I have some fixed point out here, conditioned on the path up to this stopping time, the conditional probability that this point is going to be on the left, ultimately, so will be on the left after I finish the path, is equal to the probability that a Brownian motion started at this point hits the left side of this domain. So you divide the boundary of the domain you get, taking the original domain minus this path, that domain is divided into, the boundary is divided into two pieces by these two points, and you say the probability you hit on the left, so either on the left side of here or the left side of your path, is equal to the probability that this path ends up on the left of your curve. And so that's something you can prove. So SLE4 is the only random path that satisfies this. And I'll say a little bit more about why that's true in a later lecture. So from that, if you go back to one of these pictures, well, you can see, if I fix a point out here and I start drawing in my interface, I know that when I'm all done, this point is either going to be lambda or minus lambda. You know, there's a very small chance it will be right on the interface. Very high probability it will either end up being minus lambda or it will end up being lambda. And so now what I want to say is that, I draw in this path, and I stop at some time. Given the path up to some time, what's the conditional probability that it ends up being lambda versus minus lambda? Well, that can be read off from just the expected height. Right? It's going to be lambda or minus lambda. What's the expected height now? That tells you the probability it will ultimately be lambda. And from that, you know, you get this probability from the height gap lemma that probability is indeed approximately the probability that a random walk start at that point hits the left side of the path, which, in the fine mesh limit, is the same as that for Brownian motion hitting the path. So in order to actually prove these things, we start to need some more abstract machinery. So I gave you, what I mean by these things. What I gave you gives you a sketch of how you can prove that these discrete paths converge in law to SLE4. So just getting convergence in law. But there's another question that you might ask is, well, you'd like to show that the notion of a contour line of the continuum Gaussian free field is meaningful. And you'd like to then say that if I have the sequence of D and phi sub D's, and I take a continuum Gaussian free field, well, given a continuum instance, I can project it on for each of these D's and get one of these random paths. And I'd like to say that those paths are converging to the level line of the continuum free field, which is a well-defined continuum line. And so in order to prove that, we need some abstract nonsense. So to start with, something we'll be using is almost independence, which says if I take a Gaussian free field on bounded domain, say a disk, and I look at two open sets, two subdomains that are a positive distance away from each other, then the Gaussian free field in one is approximately independent of the other. And by approximately independent, what I mean is that the joint law is absolutely continuous with respect to the product of the individual laws. Okay, and this is actually not so hard to prove. One way to prove it is to sort of take an intermediate line and look at the space of functions that are harmonic off of this line. And so you say, I'm going to first sample that, and then condition on that, I'll sample these two things. And once you've sampled along that line, these two things are really independent of each other. And you show that the amount that you learned by sampling on this line isn't too great. It changes your expectation of what's going to happen here by this random harmonic function. But the random harmonic function really, once you get far away from this line, is finite and bounded and well-behaved. So that's a sketch of one way to do it. There's this concept of local sets. So in the discrete Gaussian free field, a vertex-valued function, A, on the set of possible instances of the free field, I'm going to call it local if A of H1 and A of H2 are equal whenever H1 and H2 agree on A. So the classic example being this interface I drew. So when I drew this interface, it was local. Well, meaning to draw it, I only had to... So the set of hexagons on either side of the interface is a local set. Why? Well, in order to look, determine that set, I only had to observe the heights on that set. I didn't have to look anywhere else. And if I were to change the height somewhere else, you know, off of this interface, that's not going to change what the interface is at all. So it's local. And the set is determined by the values on itself. And that's what I'm going to call a deterministic local set. What I mean is it's given H, this is a deterministic function of H. There's no randomness once H is known. Okay, but there's also notion of non-deterministic local set. For example, what if instead of saying always taking a zero height level line, I said toss a coin and with probability 1/2 take a zero level line, with probability 1/2 take a plus level line. Okay, now this is a random set coupled with H, and but it's still coupled in such a way that that given H, if I give you any set A naught of vertices and ask what's the probability my path is contained in A naught given H, well, that conditional probability is a measurable function of the values in A naught, and so that's a non-deterministic local set. It's a coupling. And sometimes it's easier to prove things are non-deterministic local sets than it is to show they're deterministic. So, let's see, how long am I supposed to go? 5 minutes? Okay, I mean, I do have 2 more hours, so I don't have to get everything in today. So, okay, well, so maybe I'll try to just to get through the definition of local set, and then so let's see. Should I say this? So well, first, is this definition clear? What I wrote up here? Okay. So let me give you an equivalent definition of local. So a subset A of the vertices of D, coupled with an instance of the Gaussian free field with some boundary conditions, is local if and only if for every deterministic subset of the vertices, the subset B, and phi that is supported on B, this event that B does not intersect the empty set is independent of this random variable. Okay, so what on earth does that mean? So let me try to make this clear. If I give you any subset B, and this is something that works in both the discrete and the continuum, so in discrete cases would be a finite set, continuum, say, take an open set. And then there's a decomposition. I can write H sub D as the orthogonal decomposition of what I'll call harm sub B. So the orthogonal decomposition of that with the, I'll call sup sub B. So harm is the space of functions that are harmonic on B. Or, you know, if you like, the closure of the space of smooth functions harmonic on B. And this sup B is the space of closure of the space of functions supported on B. Closure of the space of smooth functions supported on B, this H sub D. So I've got functions supported on B and functions harmonic on B. And what you can check, just integration by parts, is that these subspaces are orthogonal. If I take one and one, one or the other, I take their Dirichlet inner product, it's going to be zero. And they span the space. So this is my decomposition. And so when I say, you know, observe the heights off of B, what am I doing? Well, essentially, that's equivalent to looking at the projection of the Gaussian free field onto harm B. So observe heights off of B means look at the projection of H onto harm B. Okay, and now sub B is independent of that. So when I say a function is determined by its projection onto harm B, the way of saying that is that it's independent of sub B. And so, what does it say? So if I condition on A not intersecting B, if I condition on that, well, conditioned on that, the law of the free field, if this is a local set, is just given by the free field with boundary conditions being the values I observe on this set. And these boundary values don't tell you anything about the projection of H onto sub B. And so if I condition on this not hitting B, that tells me nothing about the sub B projection. So if I condition that it does hit B, that also tells me nothing about the sub projection. So I can really say that projection onto sub B is independent of the event that this local set hits B. So, and you can really check that that's sufficient. So, so a set is local if and only if, I've got it here, this, every deterministic subset B, and I can just say take any particular function supported on B, the H inner product with that particular function supported on B is independent of the event that this set hits B. Okay, so that's the that's another definition of local. And the nice thing about that definition is that that makes sense in the continuum as well. Okay, now, so to define the continuum, first the space of all closed subsets of H, I denote that gamma, and by G, the Borel sigma algebra you get using the Hausdorff metric on this set. And I define Hausdorff metric with respect to the, well, okay, with this funny distance where you'd kind of like your half plane to be compact. Half plane was a convenient domain in some ways, but it's inconvenient that it's not compact. So what you do is you just map it. You let it, you want to have a metric that's compact, so you just let it inherit the metric you get by conformally mapping onto, say, the disk. So you use that metric, a metric that makes it compact, and then you define the Hausdorff topology in that metric. And now the space of closed subsets called gamma is this, it's a compact metric space. Very simple. And a continuum locum set is a random element of this compact metric space with the Borel sigma algebra. And it's local if, well, when I say, I mean, basically it's what you think it should be. So this is now a coupling of the free field and the set. It's local if, well, you know, if I, when I change the values of the field off of the set, that doesn't change the set. You know, so when it's deterministic. And when it's non-deterministic, I'm saying, well, if I want to know the probability that this path stays within the set, that's completely measurable with respect to the values on that set. And if I took a B somewhere else, it would be measurable with respect to harm B. Okay, so that's the definition of continuum local set. And their homework exercise is to, I'm going to give you a union of local sets. If I give you two local sets, A1 and A2, there's a way to couple them with the Gaussian free field in a way that preserves the marginal laws of, I'm now going to find it a triple, H of A1 and A2. And there's a unique way to couple this triple so that, you know, H and A1 look the same as before, the marginal of H, A2 looks the same as before, and conditioned on H, the laws of A1 and A2 are independent of each other. So you just think of it, it's like first you sample H, and then independently you sample A1 and A2 from what the conditional law would have been in their individual couplings with H. And so if I take this triple coupling like that, I can now look at, ask about the union of A1 and A2. And the homework is to prove that if A1 and A2 are local, then the union is also local. And so this is a, you know, it's a simple exercise, but it's only simple if you understand the definition of local and gassy and free field and all this business. So if anyone actually wants to do this, you know, I'll leave these slides up. You can write down the definitions. Okay, so that's all for today. Thank you.